Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. This year, Democracy Now! Turns 25 years old. That's right, 25 years of bringing you the voices and stories you won't hear in the corporate media. Democracy Now! Has always refused to take government or corporate funding because nothing is more important to us than our editorial independence. Nothing is more important to us than telling you the truth. But that means we rely on you, our audience, for support. Please visit democracynow.org right now and make your $25 contribution in honor of our 25th anniversary and help us stay on air for another 25 years and then another 25 after that. Thank you so much. And remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. Wearing two is even better. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The yeas are 57. The nays are 43.
The Senate has acquitted Donald Trump for inciting the deadly January 6th insurrection at the Capitol as just seven Republicans joined Democrats voting to convict.
January 6th will live as a day of infamy in the history of the United States of America. The failure to convict Donald Trump will live as a vote of infamy in the history of the United States Senate.
We'll air highlights from the impeachment proceedings and speak to former Reagan administration attorney Bruce Fein, who joined Ralph Nader calling for senators to subpoena witnesses. Then, as the U.S. death toll from COVID-19 approaches 500,000, a new report says nearly 40% of those deaths were avoidable. We'll speak to the report's co-author, Dr. Mary Bassett, the former health commissioner of New York City, who's now at Harvard University.
The Lancet Commission on Public Policy in the Trump era went beyond the idea that the COVID-19 was a result of failures in public health and in healthcare access. All of these are big problems. And it looked also at the long-term trends that have made the United States so vulnerable to the worst pandemic in a century.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate's acquitted Donald J. Trump for inciting the deadly January 6th Capitol insurrection in his second impeachment trial. 57 senators backed convicting the former president, but the vote fell short of the two-thirds majority needed. It was the most bipartisan impeachment trial verdict ever, with seven Republicans voting with Democrats to convict. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer blasted Republicans for siding with a president who tried to overturn an election and incited a mob to attack the Capitol.
This was about choosing country over Donald Trump. And 43 Republican members chose Trump. They chose Trump.
Shortly after the vote, Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who voted to acquit Trump, took to the floor to criticize the former president.
There's no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day.
But McConnell went on to defend his vote to clear Trump on constitutional grounds.
But in this case, the question is moot because former President Trump is constitutionally not eligible for conviction.
President Trump could have been tried while still in office, but it was Mitch McConnell who refused to bring senators back from recess in January to hold the trial. Calls are now growing for Trump to face criminal prosecution, as well as the formation of a government commission to investigate what happened. Meanwhile, some Republicans who voted to convict Trump are already facing fallout. Republican Senators Bill Cassidy of Louisiana and Richard Burr of North Carolina were both censured by their state parties for voting to convict Trump. We'll have more on the Senate trial after headlines. New information continues to emerge about the insurrection participants. The New York Times reports at least six people who were part of the mob that entered the Capitol worked as security for Trump ally Roger Stone and were linked to the far-right Oath Keepers. HuffPost is reporting at least 57 state and local Republican officials were at the Capitol insurrection, and almost all have faced calls to resign. Only two have stepped down. Both were arrested for taking part in the riot. In one case, a Florida County Commissioner, Joe Mullins, sponsored buses to transport people to Washington, D.C. In the lead up to January 6, he said on a local radio program, quote, "Maybe there are some liberals. I'd like to see their heads cut off." New COVID-19 cases in the U.S. continue to fall steadily as states around the United States start to loosen restrictions. Republican governors in Iowa, Montana, and North Dakota have lifted statewide mask mandates despite warnings from the Centers for Disease Control to leave mask requirements in place. Public health experts warn daily case numbers remain dangerously high and that rapidly spreading virus variants could create new surges. Researchers have found at least seven fast-spreading coronavirus lineages in the U.S. with the same mutation, providing more evidence that variants are evolving to become more transmissible. The U.S. is now administering nearly 1.7 million COVID-19 vaccinations per day on average, surpassing President Biden's goal of 1.5 million a day. Chief White House medical advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci told NBC he believes the overwhelming majority of people in the U.S. could be vaccinated by the middle or end of summer.
By the time we get to April, that will be what I would call, for, you know, for better wording, open season. Namely, virtually everybody and anybody in any category could start to get vaccinated.
Fauci said vaccines for children as young as 6 or 7 could be authorized by the start of the next school year. The CDC issued new guidelines Friday for schools to reopen safely. The agency says vaccinating teachers is not a prerequisite, but schools must adhere to strict measures, including mandatory face masks, physical distancing, and contact tracing. CNN notes 99% of U.S. children live in what the CDC considers a red zone, an area with high levels of community transmission, for which the agency recommends virtual classrooms for middle and high schools and hybrid learning for elementary schools. A recent National Education Association survey found only 18% of teachers who responded were vaccinated, although a large majority wanted to be. White teachers have been vaccinated at over twice the rate of Black teachers around the United States. A new British government study builds on earlier reports that a fast-spreading variant first found in the UK leads to an increased risk of hospitalization and could be up to 70% more deadly. This comes as disability rights advocates in Britain are condemning the discriminatory response by the government and hospitals in treating COVID-19 patients with mental disabilities. A recent investigation found do-not-resuscitate orders were given to people because they had mental disabilities, causing potentially avoidable deaths. CNN reports a World Health Organization team probing the origins of COVID-19 in Wuhan, China, believes the outbreak was much more widespread in December 2019 than officials have revealed. Elsewhere, New Zealand's largest city, Auckland, is in a three-day lockdown after three coronavirus infections were identified. It's New Zealand's first lockdown in 6 months after Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern's government stamped out the virus. Guinea has declared an Ebola epidemic after an outbreak killed at least three people and sickened four others. They're the first cases in Guinea since 2016, when health officials declared an end to the world's largest ever Ebola epidemic, which killed more than 11,000 people across West Africa. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization has identified three new cases of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo. In Burma, Armored vehicles have been unleashed on the streets of major cities as mass protests opposing the military coup continued for the 10th consecutive day today. In the northern state of Kachin, security forces fired at a crowd of protesters that had gathered outside a power plant Sunday. They also used water cannons to disperse the crowd. Five journalists were arrested while covering the clash. On Sunday, security forces raided the homes of several prominent critics of Burma's military coup. Activists around the world are calling on Indian authorities to free Disha Ravi, a 22-year-old climate activist who was arrested over the weekend. She's accused of sharing an online document, which was tweeted by Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, with information on how to support the ongoing farm workers' protest. Ravi is one of the founders of the Indian Fridays for Future Youth Climate Strike. In Somalia, a blast from a car bomb near the parliament headquarters in the capital, Mogadishu, killed at least three people and wounded at least eight others on Saturday. The attack came amidst a deepening political crisis, which led to the postponement of elections last week. The militant group Al-Shabaab has threatened to attack the polls. Massive protests continue in Haiti as thousands are taking to the streets demanding the resignation of President Jovenel Moïse, accusing him of orchestrating a coup to remain in power beyond his term.
Moise had the support of Donald Trump, who he was using to bother Venezuela. We're calling on the Americans to abandon Trump's policy and to get rid of the terrorist, Moise, because his mandate has finished.
This comes as immigrant justice advocates continue to denounce the Biden administration's ongoing deportations of Haitian asylum seekers. A warning to our audience, the next story contains disturbing images of violence. Advocates across the United States are condemning the rise of racist violence against the Asian American community. Last month, an 84-year-old man from Thailand was killed in San Francisco after being attacked while on his morning walk. Just days later, a 91-year-old Asian man was shoved to the ground in Oakland's Chinatown. And in New York City last week, a 61-year-old Filipino man was slashed in the face while on the subway. Asian Americans say hate crimes and discrimination against their communities have been on the rise since the beginning of the pandemic. Some 2,800 incidents have been reported since last March, according to the group API Hate. Stop AAPI Hate. Activists and allies in Oakland held a rally over the weekend. This is Connie Wan, co-founder of Asian and Pacific Islander Women Lead.
What about that violence of living in poverty under a system that doesn't seem to care about our people? That's the violence we need to answer to. The vigilantes coming out here calling for more police, I need you to answer to that violence. I want you to represent for that. Our communities are also suffering deportation. Answer to that violence. Our people are in detention centers for an indefinite amount of times. I need you there for that too. And then, you're not even accounting for the gender violence that our women are experiencing. I need you to account for that.
Allegiant Airlines has come under fire after they kicked four black teenagers off a flight last week, leaving them stranded in Arizona, far from their homes in Sacramento, California. The teens were in Arizona with their basketball team and are part of a youth mentorship program called Voice of the Youth. Allegiant Airlines alleges they were not wearing their face masks properly, but the boys say they adjusted them when asked by airline staff. One teen says he was afraid for his life when police showed up to remove them from the plane. A coalition of international human rights and legal groups are preparing to submit a report to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights about racist police practices in the United States. The report will be based on the findings of the International Commission of Inquiry on Systemic Racist Police Violence Against People of African Descent in the United States as part of 3 weeks of hearings. Tamika Palmer, the mother of Breonna Taylor, testified before the commission about how her 26-year-old daughter was shot to death in her own home in Louisville by plainclothes officers serving a no-knock warrant.
Brianna was in one of the safest places in the world to be. She was home with the person she thought would protect her from the world. And he tried to do just that. With the laws that are given to us to protect and serve our kingdoms. And when that law was broken, there was no accountability for the people that broke that law, for the people who perjured themselves to obtain a warrant that put those people in motion that night, for Daniel Cameron, who lied about the case he presented to the grand jury and getting justice for Bree, and never gave them the opportunity to charge the other officers, even when asked.
That was Breonna Taylor's mother, Tamika Palmer. You can read and watch all the testimonies from the Inquiry on Systemic Racist Police Violence at inquirycommission.org. The New York Police Department's arrested an individual in connection with four stabbing attacks on unhoused people in the subway over the weekend, which left two of the victims dead. NYPD announced it was adding 500 more police officers to patrol subways. Organizer Whitney Hugh responded on Twitter, "There's always money for more cops in the subway system, but never enough money to actually house the homeless and keep them safe and warm." In news from the White House, Deputy Press Secretary T.J. Ducklow has resigned following revelations last week he made threatening and misogynistic comments to political reporter Tara Palmieri, telling her, quote, "I will destroy you," after she asked him to comment on his romantic relationship with an Axios reporter. Ducklow had originally been suspended for a week. President Biden told incoming staff during a swearing-in ceremony that if anyone spoke to a colleague with disrespect, quote, "I will fire you on the spot." And longtime investigative journalist Jim Ridgway has died at the age of 84. Ridgway was the Washington correspondent for the Village Voice for 30 years. He also wrote for Mother Jones, Ramparts, The New Republic, The Nation, and other outlets in a career that spanned six decades. In 2010, Jim Ridgway co-founded Solitary Watch, focused on the plight of prisoners in solitary confinement. Some of their stories appeared in Ridgway's book, Hell is a Very Small Place, Voices from Solitary Confinement. You can see our interviews with James Ridgway at democracynow.org. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. When we come back, the Senate's acquitted Donald Trump for inciting the deadly January 6th insurrection. We'll talk with a former Reagan administration lawyer about what the acquittal means and what the House Democratic managers could have done to change that verdict. Stay with us. USA by The Clash. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Seven Republicans joined with all 50 Democrats Saturday, voting to convict Donald Trump for inciting the deadly January 6th insurrection at the Capitol. But the vote fell far short of the two-thirds majority needed. Senate President Pro Tem Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy read the results of the vote.
The yeas are 57. The nays are 43. two-thirds of the senators present not having voted guilty. The Senate judges that the respondent, Donald John Trump, former president of the United States, is not guilty as charged in the article of impeachment.
Shortly after the vote, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer blasted Republicans for siding with Donald Trump.
January 6th will live as a day of infamy in the history of the United States of America. The failure to convict Donald Trump will live as a vote of infamy in the history of the United States Senate. This was about choosing country over Donald Trump, and 43 Republican members chose Trump. They chose Trump. Even though Republican senators prevented the Senate from disqualifying Donald Trump for any office of honor, trust, or profit under these United States, there is no question Donald Trump has disqualified himself. I hope, I pray, and I believe that the American people will make sure of that.
While the Senate cleared Trump, he could still face criminal charges for his actions on January 6th. Republican Senate Leader Mitch McConnell took to the floor after voting to acquit Donald Trump.
Former President Trump's actions preceded the riot were a disgraceful dereliction of duty. There's no question, none, that President Trump is practically and morally responsible for provoking the events of the day. No question about it. The people who stormed this building believed they were acting on the wishes and instructions of their president. And having that belief was a foreseeable consequence of the growing crescendo of false statements, conspiracy theories, and reckless hyperbole, which the defeated president kept shouting into the largest megaphone on planet Earth. With police officers bleeding and broken glass covering Capitol floors, he kept repeating election lies and praising the criminals. If President Trump were still in office, I would have carefully considered whether the House managers proved their specific charge. By the strict criminal standard, the president's speech probably was not incitement. However, in the context of impeachment, the Senate might have decided this was acceptable shorthand for the reckless actions that preceded the riot. But in this case, the question is moot because former President Trump is constitutionally not eligible for conviction.
That's Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell. Well, soon after, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi criticized McConnell for preventing the Senate from holding a trial while Trump was still in office in January.
So for Mitch McConnell, who created the situation where it could not have been heard before the 20th, or even begun before the 20th in the Senate, to say all the things he said, oh my gosh, about Donald Trump and how horrible he was and is, and then say, but the time that the House chose to bring it over, no, we didn't choose. You chose not to receive it.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called McConnell pathetic. She made this surprise appearance at the House managers' news conference after the Senate acquitted Donald Trump. Meanwhile, some Republicans who voted to convict Trump are already facing fallout. The Louisiana Republican Party has censured Senator Bill Cassidy. The North Carolina Republican Party is voting today to censure Richard Burr. The biggest surprise in the closing 2 days of the trial centered on the question of calling witnesses. On Friday night, Republican Congresswoman Herrera Butler released a statement revealing that Republican House Leader Kevin McCarthy had told her about a call he had with President Trump amidst the January 6th insurrection, where Trump expressed support for the rioters. Trump reportedly told McCarthy, "Well, Kevin, I guess these people are more upset about the election than you are," unquote. Kevin McCarthy then reportedly responded something like, "Who the F do you think you're talking to?" On Saturday, the House impeachment managers called for witnesses, a move that could have prolonged the trial by weeks or even months. The Senate then voted to allow witnesses. But after Republicans threatened to call over 100 witnesses, the impeachment managers agreed to forgo calling any if Congresswoman Butler's statement could be put into the record as evidence. It was. We are joined now by Bruce Fein. He was Associate Deputy Attorney General and General Counsel of the Federal Communications Commission under President Reagan. He previously served as counsel to Republicans on the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran. He's a constitutional lawyer who's testified on countless occasions before Congress and author of the book American Empire Before the Fall. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Bruce Fein. It's great to have you with us. Can you start off by responding to the acquittal of Donald J. Trump on Saturday?
First, I think I would recharacterize the nature of the charge. It wasn't insurrection against the Capitol alone. It was a stab in the back of the United States Constitution and 230 years of unbroken, peaceful transitions of presidential power. Because the purpose of the storming wasn't just to defile the Capitol or even threaten lives. It was to prevent Mike Pence, the vice president, from executing his constitutional duty under the 12th Amendment and the Electoral Count Act to count state-certified electoral votes that would pronounce Joe Biden the winner by having captured a majority. It was an effort, basically, to destroy the rule of law and the Constitution itself. It would put us in the same situation that Russians find with Mr. Putin and his elections or President Xi in China. That was what this was about. It wasn't some kind of garden variety, just riot. It was an effort to undo 230 years of heroic sacrifices of our founding fathers, of those who fought at Cemetery Ridge, Omaha Beach, and otherwise. That was what was at stake here. And to characterize it as an insurrection is, I think, vastly downplays the importance of the issue. The second thing that I want to underscore is that it's conceptually wrong to think of impeachment as an after-the-fact sanction for misconduct. Impeachment was designed as a prophylactic, something that would prevent someone from remaining in office if they created a clear and present danger to our constitutional dispensation. And whatever else you can say about Mr. Trump's speeches and exhortations and incendiary words, whether or not they in fact caused the insurrection, because there's certainly evidence of some planning by some in advance, it clearly shows a huge danger to our constitutional system, especially when you think about the background of this president saying on July 23rd, 2019, in the manner of a monarch, "Then I have Article 2, where I have the right to do anything I want as president." And he was as good as his word. He flouted the Constitution virtually daily. He turned the White House into a crime scene by Hatch Act violations and using government property employees to promote his 2020 campaign. He flouted hundreds of congressional subpoenas for testimony and information. He issued executive orders in view of legislation. He continued unconstitutional wars. On and on and on. that is not a clear and present danger to our constitutional system, I don't know what is. And it really is quite frightening that now we have a precedent that says a president has the right to do anything he wants, that he wishes to, without sanction. That is no longer the rule of law.
So I want to go to this issue of the witnesses. Let's go to the lead House impeachment manager, Congressman Jamie Raskin of Maryland, speaking on Meet the Press Sunday, defending the decision not to call witnesses during the trial.
We have no regrets at all. We left it totally out there on the floor of the U.S. Senate, and every senator knew exactly what happened. And just go back and listen to McConnell's speech. Everybody was convinced of the case we put forward. But, you know, as the defense lawyer said, just pick any one of these phony constitutional defenses, and then you can justify it. It could be First Amendment. It could be Bill of Attainder. It could be due process. All of them are nonsense. I thought that I successfully demolished them at the trial. But, you know, there's no reasoning with people who basically are, you know, acting like members of a religious cult, and when they leave office should be selling flowers at Dulles Airport.
So that's lead House impeachment manager Jamie Raskin. Bruce Fein, your response.
I think Jamie, and he's a professional friend and at least a semi-personal friend, I think he misconceived the nature of the audience of an impeachment trial. It's not just the senators. It's all the American people, everyone who voted. The president is a nationwide election. And he needs to convince not only the senators, if this is going to work and have lasting effect, he needed to have a case that convinced the American people. They don't live inside the Beltway, most of them don't, and aren't immersed of this every day like he is and perhaps the senators. And that was the need for the witnesses. Now, also, he overlooks the fact that the defense raised the issue that Congresswoman Butler's exchange with Kevin McCarthy made relevant. They argued that Mr. Trump was calling for peace during the storming, during the insurrection, that he wanted them to stop. It's obviously not true if Mr. McCarthy is correct and Ms. Butler is, and there's other evidence as well.
So I want to go to Jamie Raskin on this issue of Butler. This was Saturday, before the impeachment trial concluded. Senators voting in favor of allowing witnesses, which threatened to extend the proceedings. The development came after a Republican Congress member came forward, we're talking about Jamie Herrera Butler, about comments Trump made during his assault to Kevin McCarthy.
But last night, Congresswoman Jamie Herrera Butler of Washington State issued a statement confirming that in the middle of the insurrection, when House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy called the president to beg for help, President Trump responded, and I quote, "Well, Kevin, I guess these people are more upset about the election than you are." Needless to say, this is an additional critical piece of corroborating evidence. For that reason, and because this is the proper time to do so under the resolution that the Senate adopted to set the rules for the trial, we would like the opportunity to subpoena Congresswoman Herrera.
So the request by the House impeachment managers to introduce new witnesses prompted this tense debate between the lead House impeachment manager, Jamie Raskin, and Trump defense attorney Michael Van der Veen.
The only thing that I ask, if you vote for witnesses, do not handcuff me by limiting the number of witnesses that I can have.
There's only one person the president's counsel really needs to interview, and that's their own client. And bring him forward, as we suggested last week, because a lot of this is matters that are in his head. Well, why did he not act to defend the country after he learned of the attack? Why was he continuing to press the political case? But this piece of evidence is relevant to that.
For the House managers to say we need depositions about things that happened after, it's not just not true. But if he does, there are a lot of depositions that need to be happened, and not by Zoom. None of these depositions should be done by Zoom. We didn't do this hearing by Zoom. These depositions should be done in person, in my office, in Philadelphia. That's where they should be done.
Yes, Michael Van Der Veen is a personal injury lawyer in Philadelphia who actually sued Donald Trump last year. He filed a lawsuit against Trump, accusing him of making repeated claims that mail voting is ripe with fraud, despite having no evidence in support of these claims. That's just a side note. But if you can talk about this interaction and then the House impeachment manager getting the right to have witnesses and then going back on it, not wanting to extend the trial.
Well, this is my deduction, having spent most of my life here in Washington, D.C., approaching 50 years. It may sound cynical, but I think the Democrats, in some sense, did not want a conviction which would relieve Mr. McConnell and his cohorts who were opposed to Mr. Trump of the headache for 4 years trying to confront a very divided and splintered Republican Party, because the conviction clearly would have been followed by a vote to disqualify Mr. Trump from the 2024 presidential elections. And that would mean he would be out of the Republican Party and politics, probably. And now the Republicans are the ones that are facing the headache, as your show already indicated, those who voted in favor of conviction already confronting censure votes back home, clear divisions in the party. Because otherwise, I think what happened is that even though Mr. Raskin and the other House managers wanted witnesses, I think the leadership, Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi, made a different political calculation and said, why should we do that? We probably won't get a conviction anyway. Let's just leave Mitch McConnell and Liz Cheney to fight their own battle, internecine warfare, and we'll move forward and have better prospects for reelection in 2024. Because otherwise, it makes no sense for Jamie Raskin, on the one hand, to ask for witnesses after he had earlier asked that Mr. Trump be a witness, and then turn around and accept something that's no witnesses at all. After he had only engaged with the defense counsel, nothing more, and his argument, I say, that, well, he already had the evidence. If that were true, then why did he even ask for adding the statement of Congresswoman Butler? So I think this was a deal that was cut at the top levels between the Democratic leadership believing let the Republicans be at each other's throats for the next 4 years.
And there was a lot of talk about, for example, Chris Coons, who is considered one of the Biden whisperers, the senator from his home state of Delaware, walking in on the House managers and saying the jury is ready to vote, which was sort of sending message that Biden wanted to move on, wanted to deal with COVID relief and other things. The concern that Mitch McConnell could somehow say that if this trial is going to continue, he wouldn't allow any other Senate work to happen, which would prevent essential bills like that from moving forward. But I wanted to ask you about what's next for Trump. You have a number of possible criminal investigations, the Manhattan DA probe of Trump's finances, the Atlanta DA probe of Trump election schemes, like interfering with the Secretary of State, demanding to find more than 11,000 votes, the Georgia Secretary of State's probe of Trump's calls. And then you have in D.C., both the Attorney General and the D.C. U.S. Attorney, possible incitement of violence charge around that very January 6th insurrection. Civilly, you've got the New York Attorney General investigating the Trump Organization. You've got the two defamation suits against Trump for abusing and, in one case, raping women, Jean Carroll's defamation lawsuit and Summer Zervos' defamation lawsuit.
Well, the most, I believe, important is the potential for federal criminal prosecution. Under the incitement of insurrection prohibition, for those who are interested, it's in Title 18 U.S. Code 2843. It provides as a punishment for having incited an insurrection to prevent the execution of the laws of the United States, including properly counting electoral votes, a disqualification from holding future office in the United States. And that would be the equivalent of the same punishment that would have ensued if he was convicted of an impeachable offense. Now, the big issue is going to be the resolution of Joe Biden as new Attorney General Merrick Garland to pursue that. This issue of moving forward on Mr. Trump is not going to be made by low-level civil servants in the Department of Justice. It's going to be made at the highest levels. And I'm worried because if I think back about President Obama coming in on the heels of Mr. Bush and stating, and his attorney general stating, oh, yes, the enhanced interrogation program was torture, which is an international law crime as well as a crime under U.S. law. And they did absolutely nothing to pursue those who openly and notoriously conceded. They were doing waterboarding hundreds of times. That was defined by Mr. Obama and Attorney General Eric Holder as torture. And the politics is going to, at least says, threatens to interfere with the obligation to do justice, which I think would be a tragedy. Because after all, the law lives by precedence. And if we don't have accountability for this terrible, terrible gentleman, Mr. Trump, who basically wanted to turn the country back to a monarchy, then that precedent will lie around like a loaded weapon, ready to be used by any other successor in the White House to destroy the country completely and say, well, I'm just doing what Mr. Trump did. He got away with it. No double standards for me. They have to look beyond the politics of the moment to our posterity so they can inherit freedom, liberty, government by the consent of the governed, as we did because our forefathers also made sacrifices for the long term rather than their immediate self-interest.
Finally, Bruce Fein, the AP reports bipartisan support appears to be growing for an independent September 11th style commission into the deadly insurrection that took place at the U.S. Capitol. And let's just say seven people died. Not only the police officer, the Capitol police officer, Sicknick, but two officers also took their own lives afterwards. That's the total seven. But what about this independent commission and what that would mean?
Well, there's nothing in concept that I would oppose about an independent commission, but I think it's too slow. And moreover, the Constitution creates the independent commissions. It's called the Congress of the United States, where every member is sworn to uphold and defend the Constitution. We didn't need an independent commission to investigate Watergate. It was able to be done fairly. The American people saw it. We saw the witnesses. They have the subpoena power. They have more authority than an independent commission because Congress, unknown to most members and the American people, has the authority to detain people if they don't appear in response to subpoenas. They can find people. They don't need to go to court and wait hour after year, day after day, year after year in litigation. And the Watergate is the model. We need to have the Congress. They need to be accountable for the decisions, the witnesses. We've gone too long where Congress runs, flees away from any decision that requires them to be accountable for their actions, just as we witnessed on the impeachment vote, where we had some members like Senator Tom Tillis saying, well, he should be convicted because he committed a crime, but I didn't want to vote because, you know, I don't want to have to confront the voters. That's not acceptable. If you don't want to comply with your oath to uphold and defend the Constitution, don't serve in Congress.
Though I said finally one more, is it possible that still the Congress could vote to prevent Donald Trump from running for federal office? It was always said after the Senate trial, if he were convicted by 2/3 vote, which he wasn't, he was short by, they were short 10 votes, then a majority could vote to strip him of the right to run. But is there still a chance they could invoke the 14th Amendment and do that?
No, you're referencing Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. That clearly would be a bill of attainder. The precise issue that you've described, Amy, was raised right after the Civil War. And it's a case in the U.S. Supreme Court called Ex parte Garland, where the Congress sought to prevent anyone who had engaged in the Confederate states against the Union from practicing law. And the Supreme Court said, you're clearly trying to impose punishment. That can be only done with the trappings of due process in a court of law. It can't be done by legislative decree. The Constitution's prohibition on bill of attainder would prohibit going down that path.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. Bruce Fein, Associate Deputy Attorney General at the FCC under President Reagan. He previously served as counsel to Republicans on the Joint Congressional Committee on Covert Arms Sales to Iran. Constitutional lawyers testified on countless occasions before Congress, author of American Empire Before the Fall. Next up, As the U.S. death toll from COVID-19 approaches 500,000, a new report says nearly 40% of those who died, those deaths were avoidable. Stay with us. Spanish Heart by the legendary jazz pianist and composer Chick Corea. Chick Corea died on February 9th at the age of 79. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As the U.S. death toll from COVID-19 approaches 500,000, a new report says nearly 40% of those deaths were avoidable. The medical journal The Lancet came to this conclusion by comparing the pandemic in the United States with other high-income G7 nations like Britain, France, and Canada. The findings are included in a report by the Lancet Commission on Public Policy and Health in the Trump Era that faults Trump's, quote, inept and insufficient response to COVID-19, as well as decades of destructive public policy decisions. One of the report's recommendations is a single-payer reform like Medicare for All that would, quote, cover all residents under a single federally financed plan providing comprehensive coverage, unquote. President Biden has so far rejected Medicare for All, saying instead he wants to bolster the Affordable Care Act with more subsidies. House Democrats proposed a bill last week that would boost subsidies for people who buy plans through the marketplace, and Biden's already signed an executive order to reopen enrollment on healthcare.gov starting today, February 15th through May 15th. For more, we're joined by one of the lead authors of this new report on public policy and health in the Trump era. Dr. Mary Bassett is the director of the FXB Center for Health and Human Rights at Harvard University. She's also the former New York City Health Commissioner, where she served from 2014 to 18. Before that, she lived in Zimbabwe for nearly two decades, was on the medical faculty of the University of Zimbabwe. Dr. Bassett, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Can you start off by talking about the findings of your Lancet study?
Thanks very much for having me. We're really pleased to release this report, which began with work as the Assembly Commission began in 2017. We looked at the 4 years of Trump's policies, which were destructive in many ways that affected health, that have been displayed by the U.S. response to COVID-19. But as you say, we went back further, 40 years of bad policies that embraced the marketplace as the way to determine how we organize ourselves as a society. And then we went back 400 years to the foundational impact of enslaved labor and the embrace of white supremacy. So we do, in fact, recommend single-payer health insurance as the best way to assure health care coverage is available for all. Of course, Mr. Trump tried to reverse the Affordable Care Act and failed at doing that. But the Affordable Care Act still left millions of people, 28, 29 million people, without health care insurance coverage. And single payer would address that. Of course, there are interim steps that will be helpful, not only reopening the marketplace, as President Biden has done, but trying to encourage the states that declined Medicaid expansion, the principal way in which health care coverage was extended under the Affordable Care Act. The states that decline Medicaid expansion should accept it. It's at no cost to them, and it would greatly increase both the number of people who are covered and address racial disparities, because it's mainly southern states that have declined Medicaid expansion.
I wanted to ask you about the comparisons of the United States to other countries like Britain. Now, the UK has done very poorly overall with COVID. And, you know, they've got the variant. It's ripping through the population. But when it comes to vaccines, they have vaccinated at least the first shot 15 million people, which is astounding. It's far more than many countries of Europe combined. Now, one of the things they attribute their success to in this vaccination program is their National Health Service. They have soldiers, they have volunteers, various people, firefighters who are injecting the vaccines, and they are using the entire country. They're using stadiums and cathedrals, racetracks, mosques, fire stations, because they have a national coordinated approach, which is possible because they have a national health care system. If you can talk about how what has happened in the United States has exposed the catastrophic problems with having such a patchwork system that for so long in this country has clearly just benefited wealthier Americans.
You're right. The ability to dispense and administer the vaccine is greatly enhanced by a centralized system such as the UK has. And the U.S. has a privatized, fragmented system. We have had, until the Biden administration, no national policy guidance, so that you have different jurisdictions that are doing different things. And the result has been really chaotic. It's getting better, but it explains why the U.S. has been unable to deliver a highly effective vaccine that it has developed, mostly with public funding, to the population. A fragmented system can't identify the people who need to be vaccinated, has to rely on people finding their way. All of this is something that a central, nationally supported healthcare system doesn't have to deal with. So this is where the healthcare system really comes out as a problem. But our vulnerability to this novel virus really was related to broader societal failures, not only to our health system, but also to the fact that too many people work low-wage jobs where they lack labor protections. Too many people can't get affordable housing and live in crowded circumstances. That's what allowed the virus to spread so exponentially. But now we have an effective vaccine, and our system is really challenged in delivering it because it's private, driven by profit, and totally fragmented.
So let me remind people what Joe Biden said when he was running for president. He was asked by MSNBC's Lawrence O'Donnell what he would do if he was elected president and Congress sent a Medicare for All legislation to his desk.
I would veto anything that delays providing the security and the certainty of health care being available now. If they got that through, and by some miracle, and there was an epiphany that occurred, and some miracle occurred that said, okay, it's passed, then you got to look at the cost. I want to know, how did they find the $35 trillion? What is that doing? Is it going to significantly raise taxes on the middle class? Which it will. What's going to happen? Look, my opposition isn't to the principle that you should have Medicare. I mean, health care should be a right in America. My opposition relates to whether or not, A, it's doable, two, what the cost is, and what the consequences for the rest of the budget are.
So, to be fair here, this is before the pandemic. It's in the middle of March, almost a year ago. Now, Kamala Harris has endorsed Medicare for All. And this goes to the issue, Dr. Bassett, of movements. You've participated in panels, for example, with Reverend William Barber, where you talk about the importance of movements, that scientists are not outside of society. I mean, there's a reaction right now, the way Trump was so anti-science, that we just need the facts. But can you talk about what it would mean a year later with this massive catastrophe that is the pandemic for the movement for Medicare for All? Do you think this is the moment? After all, Biden did leave an opening. He said, is it doable? And how much does it cost? Well, how much has the pandemic cost us?
Right. The pandemic is measured clearly in trillions of dollars in terms of economic costs and the many preventable lives lost. We estimated 160,000 people wouldn't have died if we simply did as well as the median of the other wealthy nations in the group of seven. So this is something which I hope will help spur a movement. And we've seen a massive outpouring of anger and rejection of the racial hierarchy in the United States. And this is part of that movement, is to ensure health for all. People of color, Blacks, Latinx, people of indigenous descent are much less likely to have adequate access to health care. So this movement for health care for all, which I can't imagine anyone would disagree with, is something that should be embraced by the broader social movements. I see it as a really promising time. We've paid much too high a price not to try and not just do what we used to do, but have a better society which guarantees more access to all the things that we need for a healthy life.
Can I ask you about your experience 20 years almost in Zimbabwe? The growing concerns over the global inequity in vaccine distribution. Duke University health researcher Andrea Taylor told the Washington Post it remains to a large degree a zero-sum game, which means every dose that goes to the U.S. or the U.K. or an EU country is a dose that's off the shelves. And the shelves aren't going to be restocked for a while. Let's talk about who gets vaccines, who doesn't, and what it means, what we've learned from the pandemic. If one person is sick anywhere, we are all threatened.
You said it. That's exactly right, Amy. We have a highly contagious virus that spreads through the air that has affected every country in just 1 year with massive mortality impact. So the fact that the wealthy nations have not attended to the need for vaccination coverage in the developing world, particularly in Africa, is a risk to all of us. The head of WHO said just a couple of weeks ago that only 24 vaccinations had been administered by government sector in Africa, 2-4. So this obviously is a risk to all of us. Thankfully, the Biden administration has rejoined COVAX, the vaccination facility of the World Health Organization. But this is a chance for the United States to regain global leadership by making a commitment to vaccine access everywhere, not just for our citizens, because that won't protect us. If all of us are vaccinated and the virus continues to mutate and spread and other we'll have new strains, we will have challenges to our vaccine. We need the whole world to be vaccinated.
And the Ebola outbreak we're beginning to see in, for example, Guinea, it was believed it was eradicated in the world, what this means in Congo and Guinea.
Well, Ebola has been coming back year after year for decades now. We had this terribly lethal outbreak about 5 years ago because it reached the cities. But Ebola will keep coming. I hope we can go forward with the vaccination for that as well.
And finally, I wanted to get your comment on this controversy in New York around the deaths in nursing homes. You were New York City's commissioner of health, and I want to ask you about these allegations that New York Governor Andrew Cuomo covered up the true death toll of the pandemic on nursing home residents, underreporting the statewide number of COVID deaths among long-term care residents for months now stands at nearly 15,000, up from the 8,500 they previously state reported the higher death toll, only revealed after a report by Democratic State Attorney General Letitia James on the administration's failure to include nursing home residents in the reports of people who died at hospitals. Can you respond to this?
Well, I haven't kept up with the details of it, but clearly nursing homes were a place of initial spread. And it matters where people got infected, not only where they died. So the fact that the data weren't available in a transparent fashion is a problem. We need to know how important being a resident in a nursing home was to the risk of getting COVID. And we know that elders are at very high risk of dying of COVID. So those data should be available. We need data transparency. And that is something that should be embraced by every jurisdiction. It's something that the Biden administration has talked about. And it doesn't seem to have been the case in New York. It matters not only where people died, but where they got infected.
Dr. Mary Bassett, we want to thank you for being with us. Former New York City Commissioner of Health, now the director of the FXB Center for Health and Human Rights at Harvard University. One of the lead authors of the Lancet report will link to public policy and health in the Trump era. Remember, wearing a mask is an act of love. Where to? Democracy Now! Is produced by an amazing group of people. I want to thank Renee Feltz and Mike Burke. Special birthday greetings to Brendan Allen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. Yeah.